Dr. Deepak Chopra, internationally renowned author and speaker, is the founder and former president of the American Association of Ayurvedic Medicine. His books include Creating Health, Return of the Rishi, Quantum Healing, Perfect Health, and Unconditional Life. Humanity is always asked basic questions like, who am I? Where do I come from? What happens to me after I die? What is the basic nature of reality and of this world? And what is its meaning? These are the eternal questions. The answers to these questions have always been spoken of in terms of universal philosophy. Dr. Deepak Chopra addresses these very crucial questions to the meaning of our existence in this tape entitled Escaping the Prison of the Intellect, A Journey from Here to Here.
We are all prisoners of the intellect. The intellect, with its system of linguistically structured so-called rational thought, is a system of logic that serves as a justification of our reality map. Our reality map is based on a superstition, the superstition of materialism. The superstition of materialism says that sensory experience is the crucial test of reality. What I can see with my eyes, what I can touch with my hands, what I can smell, taste, that's what exists. If it's not available to my senses, then it isn't there. And this whole system of thought, it creates prisoners of us. It divides the seer from the seen, the observer from the observed. If we could understand completely that this division between the seer, the process of seeing, and the scenery, that which is seen, is completely artificial, if we could know that intellectually, experientially, then we would be free. And there is nothing more valuable than this freedom. It is the freedom of pure unboundedness, the freedom which gives us ultimate carefreeness, where we feel free as a leaf in the wind, as free as the wind itself. So what is the mistake of the intellect? What does the intellect do that imprisons us? The intellect imprisons us in a cage made up of fictitious images. The intellect's mistake, in one simple sentence, is this. It mistakes images of reality for reality. It mistakes the map of the territory for the territory itself. As a result, we lose touch with the true nature of reality, which is ourselves. We get imprisoned in a suffocating web of space-time and causation. We squeeze ourselves into the volume of a body and the span of a lifetime. And now the spell of mortality is cast. This is the beginning of fear, the onset of suffering, and all the problems of humanity. From our minor insecurities to our major catastrophes like war, terrorism, and all other acts of human degradation. To address the mistake of the intellect, the first question we have to ask ourselves is this. Who are we really? If I can answer this one basic question, who am I? I may find the answer to all other related questions, like where did this world come from? Where was I before I was born? What happens to me when I die? What does all this mean anyway? Now, when you ask somebody who they are, they usually respond by saying, I'm Mr. So-and-so, my name is such-and-such, I'm the president of this company, I'm American or Japanese, or I drive a Toyota or a Mercedes, etc., etc. All these questions really pertain to your awareness identifying itself with something in the environment, a name, a place, a circumstance. This process of identifying with an object in the environment has been called object referral. Or a person may identify with their body. I may say, this is my body, this bag of flesh and bones, this skin-encapsulated ego, this is who I am. But then the question is, what is this body? And why call it mine? This body, which I call mine, is really the raw material of the universe, recycled earth, water, and air. Why do I call it mine? Why do I not call the tree outside mine? Why do I not call the stars and galaxies that I see outside my window mine? Perhaps because my physical body seems near to me. This, of course, assumes that I know where this me is physically located. Many Westerners somehow feel that this me that they call themselves, this ego which is encapsulated by their skin, is located somewhere in their head. Some other people from other cultures think it's located somewhere behind the heart or solar plexus. But no scientific experiment has ever found a center of awareness in any one location in space or time. There's an interesting insight that comes to us both from Vedic science and also from the Jewish Kabbalah, that this center of awareness is in fact the center of all space and time. And it is at once everywhere and nowhere. Let's assume for a moment that indeed my awareness is physically located where I am situated, where a person can see me standing. But if this universe has infinite dimensions, and physicists assure us that it has, then infinity extends in all directions from me. Then indeed, I am located in the center of this universe. But so are you, because infinity extends in infinite directions from where you are. But so is the peasant in China, and so is a dog in Siberia, and so is a tree in Africa. Infinity extends in all directions from all of them. In other words, every point in space is every other point, and every center of awareness is every other center of awareness. But my eyes tell me this is not the case. I'm here. You're there, wherever you are. But maybe I should not trust these eyes that tell me that the earth is flat, that the ground I'm standing on is stationary, that objects are solid. These are all superstitions that I have developed because I have learned to trust my eyes. Sensory experience tells me that the ground I'm standing on is stationary, but I know it's spinning at dizzying speeds and hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour. Sensory experience tells me that the earth is flat and nobody believes that anymore. Sensory experience tells us that the objects of our perception are solid, and we know that they're ultimately made up of atoms, which in turn are particles that are whizzing at dizzying speeds around huge empty spaces, and that these particles aren't material objects, but fluctuations of energy in a huge void of information and energy. So maybe we shouldn't trust the senses that much. The truth is, I am here, but I am also everywhere else. That you are there, but you're also here. Because here is there, and there is everywhere, and of course, everywhere is nowhere, specifically. Or take the question of time. Infinite time extends backwards from this moment. Infinite time extends forwards from this moment. So this moment is really at the center of infinity. But so is every other moment, because infinity in time extends backwards and forwards from every other moment. So every moment in time is every other moment in time. Time, too, is non-local. And the fact that we can localize it is just another perceptual artifact based on the quality of our attention.
As T.S. Eliot says in one of his most memorable pieces of poetry, time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage, which we did not take, towards the door we never opened into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind.
So you see, now we are really in trouble. I don't even know where I'm located in either space or time. If I cannot localize myself here or there or anywhere, then how can I say that this body, this physical body, is close to me? I don't even know where I am. And not that tree or that other body or any other body. How can I say that this body is mine and not that other body, not that tree, not those galaxies, not those stars? So you say, okay, maybe I'm not the environment, maybe I'm not the body. I must at least be my thoughts, my feelings, my emotions. At least those are truly mine. But who can truly, honestly claim to know where these thoughts, these feelings and emotions come from? Where do they come from? Where do they disappear? And if I can't hang on to any specific location in either space or time, then how can I claim exclusivity over my thoughts? In fact, there is no idea you have or I have that either you or I can claim to be exclusively and uniquely ours. As Nietzsche said, although we live under the assumption that we think, it's more likely that we are being thought. So now we are in the horns of a true dilemma. If I cannot claim exclusivity over a particular body, a particular environment, a particular psychological makeup, what can I hang on to? What can I call my own? And here the knowledge of the Veda saves us. Replace that word exclusive with the word inclusive. I'm not just this body, just this environment, just this psychological makeup. I am all bodies, all environments, all possible psychological makeups. I am pure potentiality. I am the universe. The only real I is the whole endless process. I am whatever is going on, whatever is happening. If I look outside and see the stars and galaxies, that's what's happening. That's what's going on. And that's me. I am the light, and I am the eyes that perceive it. I am the music, and I am the ears that hear it. I am the wind, and I am the birds' wings that fly in it. There is no other I than the entire universe. What I seem to be is just a certain quality of my attention to myself. In fact, the whole mechanics of creation is just that, changing qualities of attention of the self to itself. So obviously the next question is, where is this self? Where can I find it? How do I go about finding it? Is it in my brain, in my heart, in my solar plexus, in my right big toe? Where is it? Dr. Wilder Penfield, who used to be a well-known neurophysiologist and a neurosurgeon, one of his classic experiments was that he would operate on patients, and as he was doing brain surgery, he would take an electrical probe and he would stimulate different parts of the motor cortex in order to see which part of the brain controlled which part of the body. And in one of his classical experiments, he was stimulating a certain part of the motor cortex, and as he was doing, the patient's arm started moving up. And he asked the patient, he said, "What's happening?" And the patient said, "My arm is moving up." And Dr. Penfield said to the patient, "Are you moving your arm up?" The patient said, no, "My arm is moving up." And Dr. Penfield said, "Well, in that case, why don't you move your arm in another direction? Move it, instead of it moving up, move it from left to right." And the patient did so. Now, here's the interesting part. No matter how hard you try, no matter what instrument you use, no matter what sophisticated gadgetry you employ, you'll never find in the brain or elsewhere in the body the location of that one that made the choice to move the arm from one place to another. You can find in the brain the location of that which executes the command. But no matter what you do, you cannot find the commander. Where is that commander that made the choice, that issued the command? The execution can be localized, but the commander is nowhere to be found. In another classic experiment that Dr. Penfield did, he was probing with an electrical probe again parts of the sensory cortex, that which records images and memories and things like that. And he had this young woman and he was probing or stimulating a part of the sensory cortex. And at one point the woman said, "I'm seeing a picnic. My mother is there and she's wearing a blue dress, and we're having cake and ice cream, and there are lilies and jasmines outside, and my aunt is there and she's brought these lovely presents, and I can see this whole thing, I can experience it, and I can smell the flowers." And Dr. Penfield said, "Are you there at that picnic?" And the patient said, "No, I'm not at the picnic, I'm just having the experience of the picnic, I'm in the operating room." And once again, if you want to know where's the location of that one that knows that despite this full-blown sensory experience, me is not in this place, but in this place, that insight, that knowledge, that witnessing value, you cannot find it in the brain. That silent witness, that one that makes those choices, that one that has those insights, that commander, is not to be found in either the body or the mind, because it is beyond both body and mind. That commander, that witness, is in the gap between our thoughts. In the gap between our thoughts, even as I speak to you now, between every word that I utter, between every thought that I have, there is a little gap of silence. And that's where I'm sitting. The thinker behind the thought is not in the thought, but in the gap between those thoughts. In that little silent gap between the thoughts, the thinker, the small self, communicates with the big thinker, the big self. That little gap is my corridor, is my window, is my transformational vortex through which I and that cosmic mind communicate. And if you don't like the word cosmic mind, you can call it a non-local field of information with self-referral cybernetic feedback loops. But that's what the universe is. It's a gigantic, cosmic, living being. And that's who I am. It may sound frightening in the beginning, but as you get used to it, you don't really lose yourself in unknown territory. You find that your true home is eternity itself. In other words, the individual does not get absorbed into an amorphous nothingness, but recognizes himself or herself as one particular holographic focal point at which the whole universe expresses itself. You and I are unique manifestations of the whole universe.